Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
The fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is entering its second day now, and 90 Palestinian prisoners were released overnight as part of the first phase of the ceasefire, the Israeli prison service has said. Three Israeli women were earlier released by Hamas. They're being treated in a Tel Aviv hospital, and we are told they're in a stable condition. Now, the long-awaited truce is aimed at ending more than 15 months of war in Gaza. Well, I'm joined by Fergal Keane, special correspondent with the BBC. Fergal, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. Now, Israel had banned foreign media, we know, from entering Gaza to report on the war for the 15-month period. Since the ceasefire, though, you and your colleagues have been on the streets there. Can you just paint a picture for us and tell us what you've seen?
I wish I could say I was on the streets there. We are still banned from entering, Claire, but as you rightly point out, our colleagues who have day in, day out, our local Palestinian colleagues in Gaza have been covering this war from the beginning, and they've been out and about. And I think one of the most striking things that I heard from one of them was that, and I won't give names because we protect their names for their own safety, but he said, you know, it's been the first night of sleep where people didn't go to bed fearing that an airstrike could come down on top of them. And they woke up this morning not to the sound of aircraft or bombing, but they woke up to children playing and the sound of birdsong. Now, you know, they may sound like small things, but they represent something huge. And that is the lifting of a state of absolute fear which people went through, as I say, day in, day out, knowing that at any moment, as one young man, Hatem, who's a civil defence worker, told us, you know, any second your life could go, or the life of someone you loved. He's in Deir al-Bala, and he described one day getting a call at 4 a.m, and as he said to me, you know, nobody gets a call at that hour of the morning during the war, and it's good news. Mm-hmm. He then went to the hospital and found that his father was dead. And lying on the floor beside his father were 8 other members of the family. And he just said, I was speechless. So it's lifting the fear of that kind of horror being an every second possibility. That's the most significant thing that's happened.
Yeah, I just was struck by a piece you wrote, which included the description of the life of Amar al-Hindi, who you went back to see. This is this little child who had his toes amputated after a bombing which killed most of his family, I believe. Yeah. Just tell us about him.
So Amr was someone, our journalist in Gaza went to film him at a hospital last October. And he was there and he was on a bed and shaking, you know, shaking with trauma, this little 10-year-old, covered in dust. People were on the floor around him, a woman bleeding from the ear, a man who had just died. The whole emergency ward was crowded and there wasn't space. They didn't have beds. So Amr was lifted from the trolley that he was on and placed on the ground so that it could be given to someone who was more badly wounded. And he was sitting there and he was saying, you know, I'm hungry. And then he said, where's Sharif? How's Sharif? And the nurse who was with him said, Sharif is upstairs. I'll take you up to see him. Sharif's okay. And of course, Sharif wasn't okay. Sharif was his brother. And Sharif was dead, along with sister Asil and brother Ali and their parents. So he was, his entire immediate family was killed in this Israeli airstrike. And our journalist went back to see him yesterday, and he's now living with his grandparents. They're raising him. But he looked like, you know, in the images that were sent to us yesterday, he looked as if he was staring at the world through this protective screen. He was extraordinarily composed, you know, piercing gaze at the camera. I've seen that look in traumatized children in war zones in many, many places. And he was asked, you know, our journalist asked him, what do you want to do now that the ceasefire has come? And he says, I want to follow what Ali wanted to do. And that was his older brother, Ali. And he said, Ali wanted to be a doctor and I want to fulfill his dream. And then he started crying. And he finished his last few words sobbing, and his grandfather, in this incredibly tender gesture, just leaned over and kissed him on the cheek and said, "Habibi, darling," and patted him on the chest. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those images of war that stay with you. But that has happened thousands upon thousands of times in this conflict.
Yeah, and that is why this will be something that takes generations to play out. And I think people have rightly made that point, particularly over the last few days as this respite has come. I was watching your report last week, Fergal, about the aid, you know, waiting to get in and so desperately needed. Is there evidence now that it is moving in the way that it needs to?
Yes, we've been following this Jordanian aid convoy, for example. So we travelled with it down through the Dead Sea Road to the Jordan Valley on its way to Gaza. And that went in. I got a call yesterday to say that that aid had gone in. And something like, I think we've been 500, 600 trucks of aid from Jordan and other countries entered the Gaza Strip yesterday. And we're being told there's now an effort to build up a major surge, you know, at least 500 trucks a day. And that's still a drop in the ocean. If you consider there are 2.5 million people, roughly most of them displaced, nearly the same number dependent on aid, a hospital and medical system that has basically collapsed, repeated airstrikes that have hit hospitals and medical facilities, large numbers of doctors and medics arrested and taken into custody. So a big part of this is just treating the immediate needs of people who also, you know, let's face it, besides the wounds of war, if your medical system is, you know, destroyed in that way, you've got lots of patients suffering from kidney disease, suffering from cancer, suffering from many, many different kinds of illnesses who need to be evacuated to somewhere and who haven't been evacuated, who have not been allowed out of Gaza. And I think we're going to see a lot of pressure now to begin evacuations of those who are seriously ill. Now, you know, some people have been allowed out, but nothing like the number who need to be treated abroad.
Mm-hmm. And then the people who are returning home, I was listening to the BBC this morning, just the extraordinary hope of one person who has thought, you know, I'm going home to my house, to my shelter where I can look after my family. Of course, there's nothing there. It's just rubble. But it's just, I don't know, it's bizarre that people would have expected those homes to still be standing when they got back, given what they've gone through over the last 15 months.
I suppose if you've lost everything in terms of, you know, the right to physical safety, number one, the right to access proper food for your children, the right to access medical treatment, hope is the last thing you have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's surprising, you know, what you describe is something we've heard from other people. They just kind of thought that maybe it wasn't destroyed. You know, there was a professor who went back to his home yesterday with one of our journalists. And he was walking up the stairs into the house and saying, "I built this block by block, this house. I painted it. I turned it into a place for my wife and my children. And look at it." And he spreads his arms wide. And our cameraman panned around and you just saw holes punched through walls, shrapnel, heavy machine gun marks everywhere. A little girl's bedroom painted pink, now absolutely ruined. Smashed glass, concrete all over the floor. And, you know, that's all got to be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. Now, it will be, but that's phase three of the ceasefire agreement, if the ceasefire lasts. In phase three, reconstruction is going to take place, hopefully with a lot of international money and involvement. But you've got to get to stage three before that happens.
And what's your sense of that, of how things have gone so far? I think the image that was most striking was when the three Israeli hostages were released. You had the Hamas gunmen with the balaclavas on. Mm. It just, I suppose, really what it does is fill you with the sense of foreboding that this thing just might not hold.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got Israeli society is still deeply traumatized, angry. You know, you have a government that is held together with the support of the far right. You listen to something like the, you know, Bezalel Smotrich, who is the finance minister, saying, "I'll bring down the government if it doesn't go back to fighting." that leads us to take over the entire Gaza Strip and governing it. There's strong pressure from elements of Israeli society to go back to war, and Prime Minister Netanyahu hasn't ruled it out. Now, a lot depends on, you know, we've Donald Trump being sworn in as American president later today. A lot depends on the kind of pressure he puts on Israel, and his representatives, or the people who are going to be speaking for Mr. Trump's State Department, have been, you know, suggesting in off-the-record briefings that there is going to be a near permanent presence on the ground in the region, and they're talking about Steve Witkoff, who is the, you know, the special envoy to the Middle East, who was very important in getting this deal across the line, being around here a great deal to make sure that some skirmish doesn't turn into a total resumption of hostilities. Because that's the danger. In the past, we have seen with ceasefires in Gaza where you get, you know, periods of peace, and then gradually they're worn away with skirmishing between both sides, and then this erupts into full-scale war again.
Fergal, thank you for joining us this morning. Fergal Keane there, who's special correspondent with the BBC, joining us from Jerusalem. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.